This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hear from an Illinois State University scholar who says even ranking police officers say there's more progress to make for women cops.
She said, I think one of the things that's impeded me or slowed me down is that police work is still a little bit of a boys' club, and I'm not a boy.
Kara Raby-Hemp talks with GLT's John Norton about her new book, Thriving in an All-Boys Club, Female Police and Their Fight for Equality. Hear part two of our report on the three-minute thesis contest, ISU grad students make their work exciting and accessible. And it's a profile of a Westside County board race pitting a 40-year incumbent against a political newcomer. Ryan Denham reports on the race between Paul Segabiano and Shana Wachinski. That and a GLT News update on the way. It's March 8th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Democratic voters on Bloomington's West Side will decide this month whether their longtime McLean County board member should get to keep his job. Paul Segabiano has served on the county board for more than 40 years. He represents District 8, which includes much of the city's West Side. His day job is director of development for the Great Plains Life Foundation, working on its Stay 4 project to reduce high school dropouts. On March 20th, Segabiano will face a primary challenge from Shana Wachinski, a healthcare professional and well-known political activist. She's one of many first-time women candidates running in the wake of President Trump's election. You'll hear from both candidates today. GLT's Ryan Denham starts with Segabiano, asking why he's seeking re-election.
I was really approached by members of our administrative staff. They asked me to run for re-election in order to help complete some of the things that we have started. And with my background and my knowledge and experience, they asked me to do that. I was also approached by several department heads to seek re-election and see some of the things that are ongoing. I really appreciate their confidence in me, and they're stepping forward and asked me to continue to serve until, you know, we complete some of these endeavors, and number one being, you know, the addition to the Law and Justice Center.
What other kind of unfinished business do you want to see taken to its conclusion with your work on the board? What other things do you want to still get done?
I think, you know, the Law and Justice Center is a major project. But to go back, I think it started in 2008 with former Sheriff Mike Emery. He asked that, you know, we do a review of the jail due to the situation where inmates with developmental disabilities or, you know, medical incapacity, they were sleeping on a floor in a booking area, and that can no longer be tolerated. Same way with our female inmates. There had to be something done. So Mike asked the Institute of Criminal, the National Institute of Correction to come to McLean County and evaluate our jail. From that process on, you know, we are now into the building of the Law and Justice and the addition. But most importantly, I think what McLean County can stand head and shoulders above downstate is our attitudes and our efforts in regard to mental illness. And there again, that started in 2008. It's 2018 right now, and as you well know, the addition of the jail is going up. But most importantly, our former chairman of the board, Matt Sorensen, convened two committees, and they were either extensive of not only private but public entities to address two issues, you know, what is the cause and what is the practice to answer them. And from those two committees came a council that we now have, and it's called the McLean County Behavioral Health Coordinating Council. Their first meeting was held in July of 16. They are beginning to address several of the issues that we need to look into in order to provide a quality of life for those individuals who need it. So mental health is a big item for us right now, and I think we stand head and shoulders above other counties downstate. So there again, it wasn't made from promises. It was made from action.
So the McLean County Board is one of those elected bodies that is actually partisan, unlike the city councils, which are nonpartisan positions. The county board has Republicans, has Democrats. There's currently a 15-5 majority among Republicans on the county board. You're one of five Democrats on the board. Can you talk about your role as a Democrat on that board and how you see the partisan split on the board and what the role is of the minority party on the board?
You know what I use as an example in regards to that issue? The American flag. And I'm a veteran. If you look at the American flag, it has no R's and no D's on it. It's our flag. It's our country. And I've learned to work within the system. In fact, when I came on the board, I was taken under the wing of many Republicans who thought that that little Mexican boy needs some help. And they stepped forward and they helped me. And they taught me. And they told me the most important thing was listen and learn so you can become effective. And I've been able to do that, work with whomever is on the board. In fact, Mr. Erickson, who is the chairman of the Republican Party, I think we talk anywhere from once to twice a week, working on issues that will benefit McLean County.
So it sounds like it's important to you that your list of endorsements here that I'm looking at includes both Democrats and Republicans. You have a Democrat like John Penn, who's the chair of the local party currently, but you also have Republicans, Sheriff John Sandage, Coroner Kathleen Davis, among others.
Yeah. Well, I was very pleased. In fact, Judge Yoder was probably one of the first ones to step forward and said, Paul, what can I do to help you? He said, I'm going to be on the ballot. And he said, I'm not violating any rules or regulation. He said, what I can do to help you? He said, I think you've been a compliment to the board, and we'd like to keep you there. So Judge Yoder is one of the first ones to step forward. Going back to why am I running for reelection, I think the most important thing is I'm sound of mind. I'm sound of body and health. I have absolutely no health problems. I think I have the endurance and the capacity to serve another term.
What's it been like for you this time around, having a primary challenger heading into the March 20th primary?
I've had them before, and I just accept it as, you know, it's a free country, and everybody has the right to run. But I want to go back to what I said a minute ago, you know. I'm not making any promises this race, and I don't intend to. I want to be judged on what I have done in the past. I think that's the best example. And I think, you know, what I want to be judged on is what I currently do, and that is, you know, working with the State Forward Project. And I'm extremely pleased and proud of that. In fact, John Penn asked us to put the foundation together, and that addresses the issue of low-income kids who are deemed probably of dropping out of high school. We work with kids up and down the state of Illinois, and probably you talk about dropout kids. We have a graduation rate of 97% of these kids. Absolutely amazing, and we're very, very pleased with that.
The McLean County Board has a lot of men on it, a lot of white men on it. And some say that it's time for a more diverse mix of people on the county board and some new faces, more women, more people of color. What would you say to that concern?
Well, I think there's diversity on the county board. At one point in time, we had African-Americans on the board. Currently, we have a Jewish member on the board. I'm Hispanic on the board. You know, there again, I said a moment ago, you know, this is a free country, and everybody has a right to run. But, you know, and I have been extremely supportive of women's efforts, particularly women's athletics. I think they deserve as much credit and publicity as men. But there again, I think you're judged on your character and your ability to serve, your willingness to serve, regardless of whether you're a man or woman. And I do agree that, you know, there's been a big push about this is the year of the woman. But what about our men out there? Men who have the intelligence and ability to run and serve honorably. So I think it's, you know, it's a voter's choice. It doesn't have to do, you know, with the sex of the person, but the qualification of the person.
What are some of the issues that that make you a Democrat?
Making sure that people are treated equally, that everybody has a right to a quality of life. You don't have to be a rich person, nor should you be a rich person, to enjoy the life that God has given us. You know, and that is, you know, a good job, equal pay, an opportunity to live in a home, to own a home, to go to the church of your choice. I think all too often, you know, and I think if we reverse back to our young people, that they should have a chance in life. And it's just like some of the social programs. I firmly believe that there are a need out there to tweak some of them, but I also know that there's a need for those social programs to care for those. I think the recent situation in Bloomington with the fire that took place, and most people would not realize that, as they said, you could throw them out on the street, and where would they go, especially those with children? So do they have to live in that condition? They shouldn't have to. There ought to be a more stronger effort to make sure that, you know, things that need to be done should be done rather than throwing people out on the street. So, you know, there are a lot of social programs that need to be looked at, but not discarded.
Democrat Paul Segubiano, a longtime McLean County board member, on why he's seeking re-election. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. His Democratic primary opponent is Shayna Wachinski. She also talks to GLT's Ryan Denham about why she's making her first run for elected office and why she thinks District 8 needs a more progressive voice.
I'm running for McLean County Board because I feel like in District 8, it's time for a fresh perspective, some new voices, and new leadership, and I believe I can bring that to the board.
Is this your first run at elected office?
It is. Yes, it is.
How has it been going so far? What's the experience been like?
It has been amazing. I have gotten so much support and people that have just reached out to kind of help me along in the process. Several months ago, the McLean County Democrats sent several of us to the Ready to Run workshop, and we got some great tools there. And since then, it's just been a really great community effort that has helped many of us, including myself.
Tell us a little bit about your background, what you do professionally.
Sure.
And you're a well-known face in terms of local political activism. So I wonder
Sure.
if you can just kind of reveal yourself a little bit to us.
Right. Well, I have lived in Bloomington Normal my entire life. I've actually lived on the west side and in District 8 since about 2000. My husband and I are both from Bloomington Normal. We've raised both of our kids here. I have two children. They're basically grown. My son's a senior in high school, and my daughter is 23. And I work in healthcare. I've worked in healthcare since about 2000. My current job, I work in the cardiology department at one of the local hospitals, and I do EKGs.
Why are you making your first run for elected office right now? I think you've been involved
right.
in politics for years, but you know,
sure.
any other cycle you could have done the same thing. Why now?
Sure. There were kind of a couple events that culminated in me getting to where I am now, if you don't mind me going back a little ways. 9 years ago, my younger brother unfortunately died of a drug overdose. And at the time, he had three small children. They were 6, 8, and 9 at the time. And I remember looking at them and telling them, whatever I can do to make sure you don't go through this pain again, or whatever I can do to make things better, I'm going to do it. And then a year and a half, not quite a year and a half ago, their mother died of a drug overdose. And you've never felt more helpless than I felt in that moment, looking at them and knowing 9 years later they're going through the same thing and maybe I didn't do enough to help. And around the same time that that happened, Trump was elected into office. And that kind of brought everything at the same time into focus for me. And I thought, you know what? I really have to put my money where my mouth is and do what I can fully. And it's just kind of led down this road, getting involved in, you know, different organizations and with different local campaigns, state campaigns, and activism, and it's just moved on to this.
What would be some of the most important issues that you'd focus on if you were elected?
I would really, really like to get more people involved in politics. I think we've seen in McLean County that there is a huge interest with people getting active and involved right now, and we need to keep that momentum going. And one of the things that I found personally when I was getting more involved was I was going to all these meetings. I would go to city council meetings. I even went to normal town council meetings, you know, and all of a sudden I realized, wait a minute, I haven't been to any county board meetings. Why is that? And then I realized it's because they're at 9 o'clock on Tuesday morning. And I work like most people. It's really hard to get there at 9 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday morning. It's really a hindrance, I believe, that people to people getting involved because they can't be there. So they don't know what's going on. So that is a big, the meeting times are definitely a big thing I would like to see changed, but also the mental health issues in town, and that goes in with kind of the opioid epidemic. I have a personal story, but so many people do, and people don't realize how, I call it a many-tentacled beast, that touches everybody, even if you're not an addict yourself or in a relationship with an addict. My father, who worked his entire life, did everything right, ready to retire, has his home in Florida, is now in Illinois in a small town, raising three children because of the drug epidemic. So I want to make sure that we are doing the best that we can to make sure people have the mental health services that they need before it becomes a crisis point or before they find themselves embroiled in addiction. I'm really concerned that the most visual representation of the work that McLean County is doing for mental health right now is a jail expansion. That's really upsetting to a lot of people. And, you know, there's budget for community-based services, and not $1 has gone into those services yet. It's all been on the side of this jail expansion, which, as I go out and talk to people, that is one of the things that they talk to me most about, is their concern that this is what we're representing and this is what they're seeing. And there are things being done, but right now, this is what people are seeing, and I don't think that's a good representation, and I don't think that's good for representation of the people in our community that suffer with mental health issues. They're not criminals, and that shouldn't be the first thing that people think of.
And you are challenging a fellow Democrat in the March 20th primary, Paul mm-hmm. Segobiano. He's a longtime incumbent on the McLean County Board.
Yes.
So why did you decide to run against him? And can you talk about your view of his tenure in office?
Really, at the time that I was deciding to run, I was looking for where I could be the most effective. This isn't about Paul, as far as I'm, you know, concerned. It was where I felt I could do the most good. I think, you know, Paul has served for 45 years, and that is commendable. Nobody takes that away from him. But I just think that I offer a more in touch, more connected perspective right now of what's going on, especially in District 8.
There are, as I understand it, three women on the county board right now out mm-hmm. of 20 members. Mm-hmm. Do you think that voters should be thinking about gender and the balance of the board as they make decisions on March 20th and then again in November?
I don't think that gender is it's definitely not the only issue. But I think when you're anywhere that policy is being made, there needs to be representation. You know, these women need their voice at the table, definitely, especially where things are going to be decided that are affecting families, affecting, you know, women have a unique perspective and it should be represented. But it definitely shouldn't be the only reason or the deciding factor, I don't think.
Republicans have a 15-5 majority currently on the county board. Mm-hmm. Even if Democrats pick up a few seats in November, mm-hmm. likely to still be in the minority. What would be your approach to being a new county board member,
right,
still in the minority?
Sure.
What would be your approach to that kind of job?
Everything is about collaboration. You know, every adult in this society has to learn how to talk to people and work with people every day that maybe necessarily don't believe in the same thing you do. But ultimately, I will be working for the people in District 8 and what the people in District 8 want. So I will be representing what they want, whether it reflects my views or, you know, whatever the situation is. And then I'll work with anybody. I don't have any problems with that. And I have a lot to learn. So, you know, I definitely want to build relationships with people and a collaborative effort.
To that effect, Paul's list of endorsements, Paul Segubiano, your primary opponent, that list of endorsements includes several Republicans, including other county board members, countywide officials.
Sure.
He says that's a sign of his ability to work across the aisle and to get business done.
Sure.
I mean, isn't that a good thing? Isn't that the kind of things that we hear voters want to see happen?
Sure, absolutely. But I also think when you are picked to represent the most Democratic district in the county, you should reflect what your constituents are asking you to reflect.
Yeah, what do you mean by that?
I know that especially like when the meeting times came up, when it came up to there was a bipartisan effort to change the meeting times, and my opponent voted with the most conservative members to not change the meeting time. And that was not what the District 8 people wanted, as far as I have been told and as far as I can tell.
McLean County Board candidate Shana Wachinski talking about her primary matchup against incumbent Paul Segubiano. She spoke with GLT's Ryan Denham. The election is March 20th. Find more election news at our new Facebook group. Just search for Election 2018 in McLean County. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, it's more of our three-minute thesis presentations. That's still to come. Here on Sound Ideas on GLT, I'm Mike McCurdy. Female police officers have made gains in numbers and respect since entering policing in larger numbers in the 1980s. Illinois State University Criminal Justice Sciences Professor Dr. Carla Raby-Hemp's new book addresses that. It's titled Thriving in an All-Boys Club, Female Police and Their Fight for Equality. Raby-Hemp says despite slightly declining numbers in this decade, female police officers are doing better. She tells GLT's John Norton the idea for the book came from a police lieutenant with 25 years experience in a New Jersey police agency.
She had entered policing in 1981, so really early in the U.S. She was the fifth woman that was ever hired in her agency, so she wasn't the first. And I asked her, has anything impeded you or slowed you down in your progression? Which was hard to believe at the high rank of a lieutenant, right? That's a really high rank within policing. And she said this to me, and it really stuck with me. She said, I think one of the things that's impeded me or slowed me down is that police work is still a little bit of a boys' club, and I'm not a boy. So that quote really resonated with me, and I was curious if other women who policed had similar experiences. She'd had a 25-year decorated career, but she still felt like she was an insider or an outsider looking into the police culture.
And this was just, what, maybe 2, 3, 4 years ago when she made that comment?
I interviewed her about 10 years ago in 2007, and she was one of the very first women that I interviewed, and after that I decided I wanted to capture the stories of women that had entered policing in the 80s, the 90s, and 2000s, because we would expect some differences from the first in the 1980s to women today that are entering police ranks.
You're purposely focusing on the 80s and 90s in this book, but you cover a little bit of the pre-80s.
You got it.
Speaking even from the late 1800s and early 1900s, I was surprised to learn that there were not large numbers, but larger numbers of women in police in law enforcement than I realized back then.
You got it. What you'll find is that their tasks were very gender specific.
Right.
So you have, during wartime, for instance, you have women policing morality outside camps to make sure that prostitution and venereal diseases stayed at a very low rate during wartimes. You also had women who were prison matrons who once, you know, the issue of female criminality comes into play and women are being housed in jails and in prisons, you have females being employed in the task to make sure that they're taken care of. Now, most of this, though, if you go back and look, was really featured around this issue of morality, that women should be maintaining the morals or allowing women to maintain morals within, you know, a prison or a jail that may not happen if you had men guarding them.
And they were more accepted back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, as you were writing the book, than they were when they really started hitting the American police force in the 1980s.
And I think the key to that is that we see women accepted within policing as long as they're doing gender-specific jobs.
Okay.
If they are in charge of female juveniles or female criminals, if they are working in the schools, if they're doing, you know, social work jobs, they're responding to female victimizations. These are tasks that, by and large, have not been, you know, crime-fighting, the crime-fighting ideas that we see in law enforcement. So as long as women stay within those roles, they haven't had as much difficulty. Once we see the 1970s, you see the Civil Rights Acts, you see Title IX being passed, and the opportunities legally for women in policing open up, and women enter policing, that's when you see sort of the real obstacles and challenges to them integrating into a full police role begin.
When most of us think of Title IX, we think of women's sports at the high school and college level. Did Title IX specifically address the issue of this, or was it just the spirit of Title IX? Is that what you're getting at?
The spirit of Title IX opened up the idea that men and women needed to be equal in education and in other spheres. And so you see this mentality carrying over. Girls that went to school in the 1970s thought of policing as a potential employment in the 1980s. That didn't happen in the 60s or even in the 50s, by and large.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with Dr. Kara Raby Hemp, professor in the Criminal Justice Science Department at Illinois State University. We're talking about her new book, Thriving in an All-Boys Club, Female Police and Their Fight for Equality. And they weren't accepted by many people in the departments back in the 1980s when women were really starting to push hard to be police officers. There was a lot of pushback.
There was a lot of pushback. And some of that had to do, I think, with being first. And so in the 1980s, most women that entered policing in the late 70s to early 80s were the first in their departments. And so this might mean the first ever to be employed by the agency, the first woman to make rank, to be an administrator. It might be, you know, the first woman to be selected as academy class president at their field training or training experiences. And so being the first had its drawbacks, right?
Sexism. But being a female was the real drawback, though, not necessarily being first, right?
Being a female was the real drawback, as sexism, discrimination was rampant. And there weren't really even, it hadn't happened to long enough that there were even solutions to this discrimination and sexism in those agencies. These experiences for women started at their police training academy experiences. It continued when they were in field training and beyond.
Can you talk about some of those obstacles they met? And sometimes it was just outright discrimination, where a police chief said there wasn't going to be any women in my department, to at the academy, even where there were obstacles, as you mentioned, that they weren't even ready for it to have female officers there. The uniforms, the locker rooms, and even basic things like that, right?
There were real challenges. One woman told me the story that there were no places in her facility for her to change her clothes. And so she brought this to the attention of her administrator. And so they opened a room, but you had to walk through the male locker room to get to the place where she could change her clothes.
Oh.
Clearly, there were just agencies that were caught off guard and unprepared. There were others, of course, that quickly got up to par.
What was the impetus, again, I guess I could use that word, what was the impetus that allowed women to be integrated more into the force? Was it lawsuits? Was it people had a brighter vision of, oh, this isn't right anymore? Or did they have to be coerced into doing it?
I think all of those, you know, examples are true depending on the agency. It's hard to look at the 18,000 criminal justice agencies that we have and sort of make one answer. But, you know, in talking to women who entered in the 1980s, many of them had family in law enforcement. And so law enforcement to them was a profession that they really aspired to. And many of them told me stories about how they wanted to be a patrol officer since they were young girls. They had participated in athletics in high school. They had competed. They were physically fit, which is one of the major challenges still today for women in policing, is that the physical exam really favors male ways of knowing strength. In other words, upper body strength, which we know men favor physiologically. And so, you know, those were the sort of challenges in the 1980s. And very few women were successful in passing those exams unless they had some background in athletics or physical fitness.
But police don't have to be tested after they leave the academy or join the police force? I mean, do they have to be tested every year?
As I understand it, some agencies now offer a sort of a bonus. I think Chicago is a good example of that, that offers sort of a physical fitness bonus if you continue to pass. There are state agencies that require yearly passing of the physical fitness test, but most municipal departments do not require their recruits, which I think, you know, you raise a good point that really questions the necessity of that level of physical fitness to do the job if the thousands and thousands of police that we have out there doing the job right now, you know, well, haven't passed that annual fitness test. And so for that reason, some people do believe that that has been held up as sort of a barrier to keep women out of policing.
On the other hand, that is part of the job. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get into a tough situation, and I could almost see, as a guy, I know women are physically weaker. If I get into a fight with three or four, whatever people, does she have enough strength? Does she have enough mojo to back it up? How have women proved themselves physically in the world?
So let's talk about that. One of the biggest barriers to women in the 1970s, and one of the reasons it took so long for them to enter mainstream policing, was really concerned about the physicality of the police role. So now, today, we know much more about how women do the job. And so I want to share with you some research.
Okay.
We know that women are great communicators. They're less likely to use force against citizens, especially excessive force, than male officers. We also know that their increased representation in policing has resulted in more peaceful police-citizen relationships. They're less likely to be named as in citizen complaints and lawsuits. This saves agencies and taxpayers millions of dollars. They're more likely to take reports of victimization for domestic violence and sexual assault and to follow up with those reports, reducing future violent attacks. So we know that women do a great job in the job of policing, is what it boils down to. They have had a very positive influence on the profession of policing. Some scholars argue that if we actually increase the number of women that we have in policing, that these sort of positive benefits will trickle down throughout the agency and will change the way that police do their jobs.
Dr. Kara Raby-Hemp is our guest here on GLT Sound Ideas. She's an associate professor of criminal justice sciences at Illinois State University, and she's just written a new book, Thriving in an All-Boys Club, Female Police and Their Fight for Equality. What have women done? How have they changed policing in America?
That's a great question. In addition to the things we talked about earlier, and that women have peaceful interactions with citizens, they are less likely to be named in citizen complaints. They're less likely to be named in lawsuits. They save their agencies and taxpayers millions of dollars. They're more likely to take reports of domestic violence and sexual assault seriously, preventing future attacks for victims. They also, in addition to those positive benefits that they bring to their communities that they police in, there's also growing evidence that women destabilize this sort of male culture, that male-dominated culture that lives within policing. What this happens to do, through a fairly convoluted process, is it essentially breaks down organizations. It makes them more open to reform and more open to change. These are really important facts right now as we look to increasing police-community relationships in the midst of what I would be comfortable calling this legitimacy crisis right now in policing.
So along the same lines is, how have men over the decades, and I suppose today, how do they accept women as, okay, maybe they've got some good ideas, maybe how they police is something maybe I should adopt or at least incorporate in some respects?
Yeah, I think the truth is the agencies that have employed women for a significant period of time now are much more open to the contributions of women within organizations. And one female officer that I interviewed mentioned that this generation and the former generation have had mothers in the workplace. They're much more open to this idea of dual parenthood. And so they've had experiences that make them much more open to women as professionals in the workplace that we didn't see in the 70s and the 80s. But I will say that I was surprised to find many of the women that I interviewed that entered policing in the 2000s were still facing overt discrimination and harassment, especially in agencies that didn't have experience in hiring women. There are women today that are still the first ever woman hired in their police agency. And that's sort of an uphill battle. And to listen to their
other stories in the 2000s, experiences that many women had in the 1980s and have those similarities, was concerning. And so I think that we have a lot more work to be done in hiring women and acknowledging the benefits that they bring to the workplace.
Illinois State University Criminal Justice Sciences Professor Dr. Kara Raby Hemp's new book is titled Thriving in an All-Boys Club, Female Police and Their Fight for Equality. She spoke with GLT's John Norton for Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy.
Breaking news travels fast, and sometimes it's hard to keep up.
Used a vulgar slur in reference to
injured in a school shooting in Western
Kentucky. Open prompting a shutdown on the
Nassar will spend at least 40 years in prison.
In a week, an Amtrak train has crashed.
An emergency alert that there was an incoming.
Deciphering what it means doesn't have to be difficult. Morning Edition is there to unpack the day's biggest stories and dig into all the details. Listen every day.
Hear Morning Edition Monday through Friday, now starting at 4 a.m. on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from Heil Group, whose strategic planning and leadership development has contributed to transformative culture change within organizations throughout Bloomington Normal. Heil Group expertise and services bring out people's best, individually and as teams. Details at heilgroup.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Illinois State University graduate students are bridging the gap between town and gown and honing their craft at the same time. GLT brings you part of the three-minute thesis competition held recently at the Normal Theater. Amanda Vanderbijl is from the College of Fine Arts.
As a costume designer, I use clothing as an artistic medium to create characters and stories on stage. For my thesis project, I costume designed Illinois State University's production of She Kills Monsters, a play that flows seamlessly between reality and the imagined world of the game Dungeons & Dragons, or D&D for short. Through extensive research, artistic vision, and careful execution, I brought the characters of this story to life. I approached this play by looking at the two distinct worlds within it. A high school in 1990s Athens, Ohio, and the magical fantasy world of D&D, where the adventurers are misfit high school students, and the monsters are the bullies of the real world. I was interested in how I could interweave and fuse the unique clothing styles of these two settings. I began my design by picturing who these misfit high school students were. As a primary source, I looked at old high school yearbook photos, drawing inspiration from 90s pop punk culture with nerdy graphic tees and neon hair. Through this research, I was able to create authentic, relatable characters like Kelly, a quiet girl with cerebral palsy, who I imagined as a low-key goth girl with black hair and dark lipstick. I then turned my research to fantasy imagery. These high school students play D&D because they can leave behind the banality of the real world and enter into the magical world as anything they imagine themselves to be. For the characters to be recognizable in this world, it was important for their fantasy garb to mirror their high school outfits. For example, Kelly transforms herself into a hardcore elven warrior named Calliope. Using color and silhouette as a means of bridging realities, I mixed the familiar with the fantastic. Kelly's everyday sneakers became boots, equipping her for battle, while her crutches became powerful swords. The exciting part was bringing my drawings to life on stage. Each article of clothing was chosen and crafted with purpose and care. Not only did the costumes allow the actors to comfortably dance, sword fight, and even fly on stage, but they were a tool for the actors to truly inhabit the characters. Ultimately, the artistic choices I made helped audience members connect to the characters on stage and perhaps realize that your imagination is a great place to slay your monsters. Thank you.
Amanda Vanderbijl is a graduate student in theater. Ben Len's work delves into sports broadcasting. Len is with the College of Arts and Sciences. This is his three-minute thesis.
2 weeks ago, I'm watching the Super Bowl with my family, and one of the teams scores a touchdown. The crowd's going crazy, and the director of the broadcast starts to cut from one camera to the next. And all of a sudden, one of the cameras whips to the side. But just like that, it's over and the teams keep celebrating. My family doesn't blink an eye at such a brief camera mistake. But I've been working in network television as a camera operator since 2001, and I've noticed an interesting phenomenon in that time. When I go out on a show and I'm watching a game with my coworkers, if we see that kind of camera mistake, my coworkers are like, whoa, and they immediately start to give explanations for why they think that mistake happened. And I've never seen that kind of reaction in a group of average viewers before. So my thesis argues that if a camera mistake happens in a live sports broadcast, to the people that create the content, that mistake communicates a variety of different meanings. Now, to my coworkers, it often communicates somebody's in trouble because they know the director of the show is probably going to yell at that camera operator, and there's some directors who may never hire them again. And we often forget that these cameras are operated by real people with families, and they're doing the best they can. Now, in contrast to that, sometimes the same mistake will happen with the same director, and there's minimal repercussions. So my research was aimed at understanding how the same mistake was communicating two different meanings. To test that, I contacted broadcast sports professionals, and I asked them to read a scenario, watch a video clip with a camera mistake, and then complete a survey. Now, the manipulation wasn't the video. Everybody watched the same video. It was the four randomly assigned scenarios that they read before they watched the video. And in those scenarios, I wanted to know if the relationship with the director or the fatigue of the camera operator might influence the attributions that they made about why that mistake happened. And I also wanted to know if those scenarios would impact the likelihood that they'd recommend those camera operators for future work. Nearly 100 participants took the study, and as predicted, there were no effects from the fatigue. So the people that took the study, they didn't care how tired the camera operator was. They just wanted to see the same results every time. But crucial to this study, I found that the relationship with the director could predict future hiring recommendations. So those camera operators that had a close relationship with the director were more likely to get recommended for future work following a camera mistake. And both those findings are important because those are the kind of results that these professionals can use right now in their careers to help themselves. And there's a lot of research out there about the people that watch this content, but there's virtually nothing about the people who create it until now. Now, the next time you're watching a game or the Olympics and you see a camera mistake, and they're out there, think about why that mistake happened and what it might mean to that camera operator's career. Thank you.
Ben Lin is with the College of Arts and Sciences. You're listening to the 3-minute thesis competition held recently at the Normal Theater. Riley McInnes delves into the effectiveness of timing, lunch, and recess.
Think back to when you're in elementary school. Do you remember how much fun it was to go and play outside during recess? Odds are you had recess after lunch. This means you're able to speed through lunch to have a few extra minutes to play. Who needed to eat an entire hamburger when you had the freedom of the great outdoors calling? You didn't realize this was going to leave you feeling hungry for the rest of the day. Emerging research is showing benefits for students by simply placing recess before lunch. This is because students have nowhere to be when they play first. They're able to enter the cafeteria and focus on eating, which leads to increased nutrient consumption, better classroom behavior, and enhanced academic performance. Now, think back to elementary school. What else do you remember? Adults. Adults were everywhere. They cared for you and nurtured you. They knew when you were struggling, and they helped you to succeed. School professionals are the trained experts who are with our students every single day and can easily detect when a school policy is helpful or hindrous to student well-being and performance. For that reason, I found it a little odd that out of the research available focusing on recess before lunch, very few studies took into consideration school professionals and their expert opinions. That is why for my thesis, I decided I simply wanted to explore and discover what the perceptions of school professionals were in regards to recess timing. Using surveys and interviews, we found that school professionals had several challenges with a recess after lunch schedule, including getting the children to calm down to eat, poor behavior, and just an overall chaotic environment. However, when the school underwent a policy modification and placed recess before lunch, the same school professionals reported significant improvement because the students were actually wanting to eat when they entered the cafeteria. They were able to focus on academics when they went back to the classroom, and there were fewer behavioral issues. Though almost every school professional in this study preferred the recess before lunch timing, there are many logistical challenges and obstacles that presented themselves that had not been anticipated for or addressed, which made it very challenging for implementation. These results suggest that a recess before lunch policy does produce positive perceived benefits from school experts, but that detailed planning and preparation are crucial for successful implementation. In conclusion, the key finding from this study is that policymakers need to focus on sufficient logistical planning in order to provide our students with the many benefits that recess before lunch can offer. Thank you.
A 3-minute thesis from Riley McInnes, who's with the College of Applied Science and Technology. Katie Graybow's scholarship focuses on how to improve the effectiveness of food banks.
According to the USDA's Economic Research Service, 12.3% of American households experienced food insecurity in 2016. The USDA defines food insecurity as lack of consistent access to enough food for a healthy, active life. Food insecurity has been linked to detrimental effects such as weight gain, obesity, diabetes, and hypertension. In response to the nation's large food insecure population, thousands of food banks have been created to provide food for those in need. Many of these food banks offer fresh produce and healthy foods. However, they are not presented in a way which encourages their selection. Many studies have been done in the grocery store setting, proving success of such strategies like product placement and store layout manipulation to increase sales of healthy foods. However, these strategies have never been applied to the food bank setting. Therefore, the purpose of my study was to determine the effects of highlighting nutritious foods on consumer food choices in the food bank setting. It is hypothesized that highlighting these healthy foods will increase the number of fruits, vegetables, high-fiber whole grains, and low-sodium, sugar, and saturated fat products that are chosen by the food bank patrons. Community partnering food banks will participate in this study. Specifically, one food bank will serve as our control, maintaining normal layout, while a second food bank will display our intervention. The control food bank is set up in a way where shoppers encounter healthy and unhealthy foods mixed together and fresh produce last. Additionally, canned goods and boxed foods are combined, regardless of sugar, salt, fiber, or fat content. Now, the intervention will include rearranging the food bank so that fresh produce and healthy options are the first thing shoppers encounter. Additionally, it will require setting up a healthy choices shelf where high fiber, low sugar, low sodium, and low saturated fat products are distinguished from their unhealthy counterparts. After shopping, shoppers' carts will be inventoried for healthy versus unhealthy foods. Additionally, content of the carts from the control food bank will be compared to the content of the carts from the intervention food bank. The results of this study have the potential to produce novel information and establish the efficacy of a free intervention that allows for the same access of foods but strategically highlights healthy foods. Additionally, this data can aid food banks in encouraging participants to choose healthy foods, potentially leading to a healthier population with decreased risk for chronic disease in the food insecure food bank patrons. Thank you.
Katie Graybow studies in the College of Applied Science and Technology, and the winner of the 3-minute thesis competition at the Normal Theater is Kristen Duffield, because sex and danger sells.
I'm going to explain how the threat of death may actually boost your libido. So life can be distilled into three basic components: growth, survival, and reproduction. The time, energy, and resources an organism invests into each of these three life history traits is called its life history investment strategy. Keep in mind that in the game of evolution, the goal is to leave behind as many copies of your DNA, which we know as offspring, as possible. And so the best investment strategy is the one that results in the greatest number of offspring. But how might these investment strategies change in response to a survival threat, such as injury or disease? Well, one option is to increase investment in survival, to fight that threat in an attempt to live to reproduce another day. An alternative strategy is to adopt what's called a terminal investment strategy. This idea predicts that individuals should completely invest in reproduction as a last-ditch effort to maximize the number of offspring produced before their inevitable death. The focus of my dissertation is to understand if and how these investment strategies change in response to a survival threat. Basically, I asked the question, do organisms terminally invest? And if so, does terminal investment depend on individual condition? Specifically, I explore how three individual traits, genes, age, and nutrition, independently influence the likelihood that an individual will terminally invest. I use crickets as a study organism for many reasons, but the most important is that I can readily and objectively measure the reproductive effort in these insects. Males attract females to mate with a calling song, which can easily be measured using specialized sound equipment. Essentially, the longer a male spends calling, the more he's investing in reproduction. Today, I'm going to show you one particularly exciting set of results from my research. I found that male crickets do, in fact, terminally invest. Those exposed to high levels of a survival threat culled significantly more than those unexposed. But interestingly, this effect was only seen in old males. Young males do not terminally invest. So why might age affect terminal investment? Well, we think that because old males are closer to the end of their life, they have less future reproductive opportunities and are thus more likely to adopt this alternative terminal investment strategy. These results suggest that terminal investment is condition dependent, and you should care about my research because understanding the factors that shift these life history investment strategies can have huge implications on applied fields of human significance, such as pest management and conservation efforts. Thank you.
Kristen Duffield also won the People's Choice Award during the during the 3-minute thesis competition at the Normal Theater. Both prizes total $2,000. Duffield will also represent ISU at the National 3-minute thesis competition. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find today's stories and interviews from John Norton, Ryan Denham, and Charlie Schlenker at WGLT.org. Find the full show podcast at our website or at iTunes. Try the NPR One app for GLT and NPR News. You can get the app from Google Play or the Apple App Store. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. You can even leave a message about Sound Ideas at 309-438-WGLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.